Network Online. It's now 1 p.m.
Welcome to London Lopate at Large. I'm London Lopate. Economist Sergei Guryev and political scientist Daniel Treisman opened their new book with a question. Why, after all the brutal manias of the 20th century, from fascism to communism, have been discredited, do we still see new autocracies rising from the ashes? In their new book, Spin Dictators, The Changing Face of Tyranny in the 21st Century, they attempt to explain the nature of the current dictatorships. It's published by Princeton University Press and brings Daniel Treisman, a professor of political science at the University of California, to our show now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Hitler, Stalin, and Mao ruled through violence, fear, and ideology, but in this book, you look at how many modern autocracies have evolved from World War II to the present, leading up to a new breed of dictators who fake democracy. Like spin doctors in democracies, they spin the news to win support?
That's right. We looked at the range of dictatorships, authoritarian governments around the world in the 21st century, and we were struck by how different some of them operated, how differently some of them operated from the classic dictators of the 20th century. So most of us, when we think about dictatorship, the images that come to mind are the dictators that you mentioned, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, people who killed millions and locked up hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of political opponents in concentration camps, and who ruled with very strong ideology, an official ideology imposed on all people in their country, who had comprehensive censorship, heavy-handed propaganda, and they tended to close off their countries from the world. So that model is very distinctive, and I think that's what we tend to think about. But then you look at a lot of the authoritarian leaders of the early 21st century, and you see people like Hugo Chavez or Viktor Orban in Hungary or the early Putin. They look very different. They, as you said, they pretend to be democratic. They fake democracy. They hold elections, but they just make very sure that they win all the elections. Viktor Orban in Hungary was just reelected again. It looks
by a landslide
on the surface. Well, by a landslide, exactly, and that's also characteristic. They don't tend to win by the 99% that the totalitarian dictators of the 20th century used to win by, but they win by large majorities. And the way they do that is primarily manipulating information, controlling the media, often in quite subtle ways. So they co-opt private media stations. They also leave a small independent press, so long as it has an audience that isn't threatening, a small audience, a fringe audience. And this enables them to project an image of democratic leadership and openness. They're also, in contrast to many of the old dictators, very open to the world. They trade, they take part in international institutions, and they try to use the same techniques of manipulating the news, spinning information, and co-opting people, corrupting institutions and using influence in the West to try and get their goals, to achieve their goals on the international stage, much as they do at home. So we see this as really a striking development in the last few decades. It might have seemed as though democracy was winning across the board for a long time, but we think ultimately the pressures of modernization and globalization do lead towards more democracies around the world. But there is a way that leaders who prefer dictatorship can maintain an authoritarian regime, even in a more modern, integrated global system. And that model is, as we call it, the spin dictatorship.
Well, haven't some hired lobbyists to improve their images in the United States and elsewhere? Is it important for them to play down the dictatorial aspects of their regimes because they rely on international engagement for financial and reputational benefits?
Absolutely. So at home, they pretend to be Democrats. They operate by projecting an image in the state media and the covertly controlled media of competent democratic leadership. But they also need to be perceived as Democrats worldwide, or at least that's their aim, because they want to be accepted in international institutions. They seek capital inflows and trade. And so the international image is combined with the domestic image. They have to be consistent. And as you say, many of them employ lobbyists in Washington and Brussels to polish the image of their regimes in the West.
You mentioned that in the case of Vladimir Putin, that was until recently. In 2018, you edited a book titled The New Autocracy, Information Politics and Policy in Putin's Russia, about the complex roles of Russia's presidency, security services, parliament, media, and other actors. But so much has changed recently. Is this whole process a bit fluid? For example, don't some of Putin's recent actions, like trying to poison Alexei Navalny, his major opponent, then having him imprisoned, allowing for a relatively free press, as you said, but now anyone who used the word war or invasion in regard to the Ukrainian situation can be arrested.
Absolutely. Putin is really an amazing example of somebody who has crossed the whole spectrum. So he started out as really one of the innovators, the pioneers of spin dictatorship. He had in his early days really quite sophisticated soft propaganda. He presented himself as a Democrat, and it was quite credible early on.
He even lost an election, became prime minister instead of.
Well, he didn't. That's right. He didn't lose an election. He had to step down because of term limits, and he made a big deal of respecting the Constitution, respecting the two consecutive terms limit in the Constitution on serving as president. So he essentially held an election in which his close associate, Dmitry Medvedev,
but he's changed those rules now.
Exactly. He in 2020, he changed those rules. So we see a very dramatic, well, first of all, we see a gradual change from 2012 when he came back to the presidency after Medvedev's interim term, but then a much faster change from about 2018. And he's really become, so he's started as a spin dictator, the old type of dictator who rules by terror, we call fear dictators. And he's really shifted from spin to fear. He's now a classic fear dictator, using terror, completely eliminating independent media, and there's no longer much of a pretense of being democratic, although he will still claim that he's supported by the vast majority of Russians. The truth is, at this point, we don't know, because doing opinion polls in an environment with this level of overt repression is just very unreliable.
So who are the current fear dictators? North Korea's Kim Jong-un, Syria's Bashar al-Assad, Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman?
Right. And you can add to that the Chinese regime. So China is a very interesting combination of the basic strategy of spreading fear, using intimidation against ethnic minorities in Xinjiang and in Tibet.
And against Uyghurs.
Exactly. And against political opponents in Hong Kong, people who would like a more democratic system. So they've used heavy-handed repression in those places. They also force dissidents to make televised confessions, which, you know, is a chilling kind of signal of violence to the population, so, letting everybody know that they need to be afraid and they need to be obedient. So there's this fear element, but they've combined that with all these high-tech new tools, which were not available in the 20th century to people like Stalin or Hitler. So surveillance tools, facial recognition technology, GPS tracking. So they're able to intimidate in a much more kind of comprehensive and targeted way, while still basically holding to this this much more old-fashioned strategy of intimidation.
And yet China enjoys good trade relations throughout the world.
Well, yes. Even fear dictators these days have opened their borders. And not in all cases. North Korea and Eritrea are cases where they still try to protect the population from contamination from outside by enforcing very strict controls of the borders. But China and most other successful fear dictators, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, they engage in international trade, even international investment, capital flows, and so on, because that, if handled right, can be a source of power for dictators.
Donald Trump once said at a rally that he and North Korea's Kim Jong-un fell in love after they'd exchanged letters.
Well, it's interesting to draw parallels. And people often ask, are populist politicians in democracies also kind of like these spin dictators that we see in more authoritarian settings? And in some ways, they're very similar. So politicians like Trump attack the independent media. They call it fake news. They provide sophisticated propaganda to their base via Twitter and so on. And they try to use their popularity to weaken checks on their power, which is exactly what spin dictators do. We've seen other cases in some other democracies like Italy. So Silvio Berlusconi there ended up controlling 6 out of 7 national TV channels for most of his tenure. 3 were state-owned, 3 were from his own media empire. And we've seen others like Nestor and Cristina Kirchner in Argentina. For instance, they increased state advertising very dramatically to from a few tens of millions, from $16 million in 2000 to almost $1 billion in 2013. And they used this state advertising to build up a base of support in the media. So they would target the state advertising to outlets that were loyal to them. So we see these techniques used in democracies, too. The main difference, we would argue, is not in the leader himself or herself, but in the environment. So in consolidated democracies, economically developed democracies that have been democratic for a long time, there tends to be a larger, more educated, sophisticated part of the population with organizational skills, communication skills, and so on that can fight back, that can resist. So I'm thinking of journalists, civil servants, lawyers, judges, local government officials, NGOs, and citizens themselves who come out and protest. So it's much harder in a consolidated democracy to use these techniques, although to a lesser degree, we see them in action under somebody like Trump. There's a continuum of different types of regimes, and clearly somebody like Trump would like to turn the U.S. system into something like a spin dictatorship. He didn't succeed. It's pretty frightening how far he got, and of course, how far he might get in the future if he's reelected. But so far, the resistance to his attempts to get around democratic constraints has been impressive, and that's, you know, a sign of, I would say, not just the institutions being strong in the U.S., but the sophisticated, educated, active, skilled, resourceful part of the population being strong, because the institutions only work if people make them work.
My guest on today is Leonard Lopate at Large here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org, is Daniel Treisman, co-author with Sergei Guriev of Spin Dictators, The Changing Face of Tyranny in the 21st Century, published by Princeton University Press. Has Viktor Orban's spin dictator approach made him attractive to some American conservatives, like Tucker Carlson, for example?
Well, again, there we see the kind of the parallel and the links between less than fully democratic politicians in the West and people that we would classify as spin dictators like Viktor Orban. There's, in fact, a lot of, if you go deeper, you find a lot of interactions between, for instance, Republican political strategists and some of these dictators or pseudo-democrats, especially in Eastern Europe and other places which have become democratic relatively recently or tottering between democracy and autocracy. So Viktor Orban actually used the services of some quite well-known Republican consultants. And there's been a lot of learning back and forth, I would say. Definitely by regimes such as Viktor Orban's, learning from the less scrupulous parties in the West, and also probably some learning going the other way. People like, well, we saw how Trump admired strongman politicians in other countries. You see the same technique sometimes turning up in both types of places.
Should we assume that Orban's margin of victory is legitimate? Because you point out that even though any number of these people win their elections by huge amounts, they tend to inflate the numbers nonetheless.
Right. Well, one thing we need to bear in mind, and I haven't seen the result for the number of seats that Orban's party or bloc will get in the parliament, but he won, I believe, 53% of the vote. I'm guessing that he will have a two-thirds majority of seats because they've set up the system in such a way that a majority of the votes translates into a supermajority of the seats. Now, in addition to that, there's been a lot of gerrymandering, again, a technique that occurs both in democracies and in this type of spin dictatorship, so that the results are greater than one might expect just based on the popular vote. And then you have to bear in mind that the media is dominated by pro-Orban state and private stations, companies. So the way that people like Viktor Orban manage to get majorities in elections is by carefully managing the news so that news that looks unfavorable to them is either downplayed or not reported at all, or else explained in some way as really being the fault of somebody else. So they divert attention, they distract from bad news. And one thing that spin dictators do a lot, this is more the Latin American examples like Hugo Chavez and Rafael Correa in Ecuador, they try to flood the public space with their own news production. So Chavez, for instance, would have these long, sometimes 8-hour long, televised shows in which he would basically keep the media watching the whole time rather than reporting on what was really happening. Because during these shows, when you would sort of ramble around, meet with people, discuss whatever came to mind, during those shows, he would sometimes actually make some important announcement. He would fire ministers or announce a new policy. And so flooding the space, in a sense, keeps out or reduces the room that's left for the kind of news that he wants people not to know about or not to pay attention to. And we saw something similar with Rafael Correa in Ecuador. So they have all these techniques that together with dominance over the media outlets themselves allows them to present an image that then gets them elected. And once they get these supermajorities, they use that in their turn to change the Constitution, to change the rules in ways that lock in their advantages.
Do we see similar strategies from some of the others you've dubbed spin dictators, like Singapore's Lee Hsien Loong and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan? What about Mahathir Mohamad in Malaysia or Nursultan Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan? And I'm assuming there may be some others because it seems to be a growing trend.
Yes, that's right. Well, yes. So they all, there's a lot of things that they have in common, and they also introduce their own twists. But you mentioned Singapore, and that's a really fascinating case for us because we see Lee Kuan Yew as really having inspired a lot of these other leaders. Lee Kuan Yew, as I'm sure you know, was a real pioneer of a kind of regime in which authority was very clearly at the top, although it was, on the face of it, democratic. He put a strong emphasis on order, on top-down authority, but he was very sophisticated about it. He created a system in which elections were held, but his party always won with huge majorities in the parliament. And he invented some of the techniques that contemporary spin dictators use to disempower potential opponents. And what's really striking also is how other authoritarian leaders or how authoritarian leaders in other parts of the world have looked up to Lee Kuan Yew and very explicitly acknowledged the inspiration that they drew from him. So we see, for instance, that both Putin and Nazarbayev, the former president of Kazakhstan, gave Lee Kuan Yew medals, gave him awards, honorific awards. There's one fascinating example of how people look to Singapore and then imitate it, which is to do with, the early 2000s, and this is when Lee Kuan Yew was already gradually moving to the background, but in the early 2000s, Singapore created what was called a Speaker's Corner or a Hyde Park Corner in one of the central parks where people were allowed to go and give speeches about whatever they liked without any fear of being punished for saying things that were not allowed.
Well, instead of outright censorship, some of these new spin dictators use lawsuits and arbitrary regulations as a means of control.
They do, absolutely. So, I mean, just to finish about the speaker's corners, Russia created two speaker's corners in parks in Moscow shortly after Singapore innovated in that way. So we see that the pattern going. But you're absolutely right. So in Singapore, for instance, many people on the opposition side, well, I shouldn't say that because there aren't many people who are brave enough to stand on the opposition side, but various opposition politicians have been sued for defamation and have ended up losing the cases and being ordered to pay very large fines. And one well-known, well, in fact, this has happened to several, but one very well-known opposition leader was made bankrupt through this process of being sued for defamation. And once he was bankrupt, he couldn't serve in parliament. He even needed permission to go abroad. So, yes, I mean, one of the techniques that many leaders use is to actually use the letter of the legal system, the letter of the law, against their opponents, so that when criticized, they can say they're fighting defamation, or they're protecting the public with necessary regulations or something like that. So it's consistent with this idea that they're really Democrats.
So should we make a distinction between governments that are authoritarian and the ones that are total dictatorships?
I think absolutely. We need to understand spin dictatorships because sometimes people tend to sometimes people don't understand how they operate and end up classifying them as democracies. So, for instance, Hungary has been treated for a very long time as a democracy, even though in recent years it's pretty clearly been something else. We have trouble figuring out where to put these regimes, like that of Hugo Chavez, Putin early on, Erdogan early on. We see that they hold elections. We see that the leader came to power through an election, and therefore we think it must be a democracy. But look a little closer, and you see that that these are often regimes that really do not give voters the ability to make an informed choice about their leaders, and that limit free expression and freedom of association just in more subtle ways than the old type of dictators. So I think we need to first recognize that there is this new form which kind of fits better with modern societies and a globalized world, but nevertheless remains essentially a dictatorship.
Well, was the end of the Cold War a factor in the creation of this new form? Wasn't it thought that developing the economies of dictatorships would create demand within them for political reform, and that modernization would lead to them becoming more democratic and cooperative? Was that just a naive hope?
I don't think it was just a naive hope. It was an incomplete hope, because I think there we do see evidence of these pressures. So as countries modernize, as rates of higher education increase, as they move from industrial to knowledge economies, and also as we see globalization occurring, so media and human rights movements becoming increasingly global, greater trade and financial integration and so on, we see those phenomena leading to pressures for more open government. And some countries do transition all the way into democracy. I think what was, I wouldn't say necessarily naive, but incomplete in our understanding of that process, was that we didn't realize that there was this other stage, there was this other response that dictators could turn to delay the transition to democracy. They could basically fake democracy in order to avoid introducing the real thing. And during this period, developed all these techniques that we've been talking about to make that work. Now, it doesn't work endlessly, and that's what we see, for instance, in Russia. As society continues to get even more modern, if it does, then the pressures for genuine democracy continue to be felt. And we saw that in Russia with the rise of Navalny, for instance. There were protests against Putin in 2011, 2012. He managed to deal with those. But then there were more major nationwide protests in 2017 and then 2019. And, this was in part related to the fact that internet penetration had soared in Russia in precisely those years. So people were connected to the internet. People were also using YouTube to an incredible degree. I think YouTube became Russia became YouTube's fifth biggest market. And so people were getting all this information, all these videos. And Navalny surfed that wave. Alexei Navalny, of course, is the Russian opposition leader who Putin, as you mentioned, Putin's agents tried to poison, and who then went back to Russia and now has been jailed for a very long time. Navalny built up his YouTube channel from 1 million subscribers to, by the end, or by today, I think it's about 6.4 million subscribers. And he published these videos about Kremlin corruption that got more than, well, the most dramatic got 122 million views so far. So with all this continuing modernization, continuing evolution of society, the demand for democracy continued. And that's, I think, a big part of why we see Putin swinging back to a more explicitly repressive, overtly repressive strategy in the last few years. And we see that also in Turkey with Erdogan, who started, you know, seeming relatively democratic, but in fact, you know, using the techniques of spin to present that image. And then after 2016, when there was a failed coup, he became much more repressive, much more openly repressive. So this it's a difficult line to walk. The pressures eventually often lead to a crisis in which the country goes all the way to democracy, or else the dictator backslides, reverts, and uses fear techniques as a last resort, really, as the only way to save their regime, with the cost that it destroys the economy. So we see, I mean, the economy under Putin in recent years has been doing pretty badly. The economy in Turkey, since Erdogan became more repressive, has deteriorated. So growth rates have gone down from about 5% a year to 2% a year. Another case, Venezuela. So under Chavez, it was much more this kind of populist spin approach. Under Nicolas Maduro, of course, it's much more repressive, and the economy's in tatters. I think the pressures towards democracy are real, but we shouldn't have assumed that dictators will simply accept that and give up. They have proved to be very innovative, and they've created this new alternative way of controlling society that worked better in a more modern setting.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. With Professor Daniel Treisman. If you sign up to become a member of WBAI during today's show with a contribution of $50 or more, you can receive a free copy of the book that we've been discussing, Spin Dictators, The Changing Face of Tyranny in the 21st Century. Just go online to give to WBAI.org. That's give and then the number 2, WBAI.org, or call 212-209-2950 during today's show. That's 212-209-2950, and we'll be happy to send you a copy. But don't forget to make that $50 donation in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, and we thank you very much. And now I return to Professor Daniel Treisman, professor of political science at UCLA, also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and co-author of the book we're discussing with Sergei Guryev, who is a professor of economics and director of graduate studies in economics at Sciences Po in Paris. Let's talk a bit about the word dictator. Didn't it originate as the title of men elected by the Roman Senate to rule Rome in times of emergency?
That's right. The original meeting was a leader who would be given absolute power for a temporary period, for I think it was 6 months or a year, to deal with, as you said, an emergency, often a military emergency. They would be the commander. When it was considered to be the only way to deal with this looming disaster of some kind, they would appoint a dictator.
Do we know the names of any of them and how effective they were?
I believe Julius Caesar was a dictator, but I mean, the danger was that they would stay after their appointed term.
Now, we've had absolute monarchs over the centuries since. Would we compare them to absolute dictators?
Well, it depends. I think there's a great variety of monarchs, and we still have some monarchs today. So, for instance, in the Persian Gulf, most of the monarchs that we see ruling, we would classify as fear dictators, but a few of them as spin dictators. They use relatively sophisticated methods. But in the past, monarchs were often constrained by councils of their barons. There are also constitutional monarchies, which have more formal constraints in the form of parliaments, which have defined powers, and sometimes even independent governments. So I think monarchy is a very broad term that refers to many different types of cases. Monarchs have also operated in different ways. So one of the first writers to discuss what we call spin dictatorship, or at least something close to it, is actually very ancient. It was Aristotle who described two different ways in which rulers could rule. And or at least absolute rulers could rule. One technique was basically what we call fear dictatorship, to intimidate the population, to divide the population, so to prevent any independent organization emerging, to keep everybody in fear. And Aristotle also described a second type of absolute ruler, who in Aristotle's words appeared not harsh but dignified. He invested in public goods and public services, built temples and so on, and he pretended not to rule through intimidation or through force. But rather to be a benevolent popular leader. So, I mean, these ideas go back a long way, and I'm sure one could find examples even in earlier centuries of monarchs who look more like fear dictators or more like spin dictators. But I think the balance has clearly shifted. The spin dictator, whether a monarch or some other kind of leader, in periods before the last 50 years, spin dictators were definitely a small minority, and the use of fear was viewed as really almost inevitable in any kind of absolute rule.
But people have seen similarities. Some have labeled Putin a czar and Erdogan a sultan. But you say...
I would say that's exactly a sign of how we didn't have the concepts. We didn't really understand this type of regime. So we reach for terms from the past which don't actually fit very well.
You say that before the 20th century, no country was truly democratic. Why? Because women didn't have the right to vote, among other things?
Yes, indeed.
Because
among
other
things.
Slavery in countries like the United States?
Of course, of course. I would date U.S. full democracy to about 1965.
1965?
Yes, after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. So I think the field of political science, the people who study democracy are looking at this much more critically than perhaps we did in the past, and asking whether some of these countries that called themselves full democracies, liberal democracies in the past, really meet the criteria for that.
Do you know any that have been truly democratic over the past 100 years?
Well, around 1900, there were a handful of countries that that I think didn't have female voting yet, but were democratic in most other ways. So Belgium, Switzerland, even France at that point. And then with World War I, many countries introduced voting for women in that period, and right after World War I. So then we start to see a larger number of genuine democracies.
Tended to be in Northern Europe.
That's right, mostly in Europe. And Australia and New Zealand, they were also very early.
Haven't dictatorships taken a number of different forms, like corporatism? What's that?
Well, corporatism was a type of dictatorship that emerged in the middle of the 20th century, like fascism and communism. And it's usually associated with Francisco Franco in Spain and Salazar in Portugal. It was a kind of alternative to representative democracy in that the leader would create some kind of institution in which parts of segments of society or particular parts of the economy would be represented. So people would be appointed to represent, it could be different social groups, it could be farmers, it could be industry, but rather than having elections in which we choose whoever we want to represent us in the parliament, there would be these appointed representatives who were chosen because they fit some category that the leader had decided should be included.
And you characterize some as mobilizational and others as demobilizational.
Right. So these 20th century dictators, some of them had very strong ideology, and they sought to basically incorporate the public into observing this ideology. So somebody like Mao would require that people not just passively observe the requirements of Chinese communism, but they had to demonstrate their adherence. So in many communist regimes, there was pretty much obligatory participation in parades, various kinds of rituals. Under Mao, there was even what was called the loyalty dance. So before getting on a train in one period, people were expected to perform this, I mean, literally a dance, a choreographed dance that symbolized one's loyalty to Mao and to the regime. So that's the mobilizational type of dictatorship. But then there are cases where really the dictator wanted people to just stay home and stay out of politics and viewed that as the real key to social stability. So Franco then really didn't try to mobilize people behind some ideology. And the goal was rather to try and create an old-fashioned structured society in which people knew their place and didn't get out of line and certainly didn't participate in demonstrations or parades. So we see these different types of dictatorship in the 20th century, and sometimes they evolve from one into the other. So if we look at the Soviet Communist Party, under Lenin and Stalin, of course, it was very mobilizational. Stalin had to force and motivate people to build industry to create the infrastructure of the Soviet state and Soviet economy. But later on under Brezhnev, all of this gradually crystallized into rituals, which people didn't think very much about. And the society really became, well, the regime became much more demobilizational in the sense that, yes, people wanted, that the regime wanted people to come out on May Day and the anniversary of the revolution in the parade, but they didn't want people to take that too seriously. They wanted people basically to just go on about their lives. So there was much less energy put into stirring up the population into active support of the regime and a lot more effort put to subtle intimidation, letting people know that they shouldn't step out of line, so demobilizing them.
How does that apply to something like the situation in Brazil where Bolsonaro has pretty much put the white ruling group in opposition to the indigenous people?
Well, that's a difficult case. I mean, I would say Bolsonaro is probably a spin dictator. He's sort of on the border. He hasn't been there perhaps long enough to classify him very clearly, but I'm sort of on the border with democracy. And he seems to be, I mean, so democratic politicians can also mobilize society, can see their, and populist politicians in democracies very often try to mobilize society, try to rile them up and get them out to parades and rallies and so on. We saw that with Trump. So I think Bolsonaro is trying that sort of strategy to rally his supporters, and a technique that occurs under spin dictators, well, really under all kinds of dictatorship and also under various democracies, especially when populists are in power, is to deliberately create divisions or emphasize divisions in society, to identify a majority which is to be praised and valued, and a minority which is to be defined as the enemy. And this becomes a way of unifying the majority through hostility towards some prescribed minority that is viewed as treacherous or well, disloyal or dangerous in some way.
You're listening to Leonard Lopit at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. My guest is Daniel Treisman, who is co-author with Sergei Guryev of Spin Dictators, The Changing Face of Tyranny in the 21st Century, published by Princeton University Press. There are a number of elections yesterday. Has the dust settled, or do we know whether Sri Lanka or Pakistan should be included in the as some of the countries that you are describing here? Serbia, another case?
Right. I haven't seen reports on Sri Lanka. Pakistan seems to be in the midst of a constitutional crisis because the Prime Minister Imran Khan has dissolved the parliament at a time when it was about to vote no confidence in him. So we'll have to see what comes out of that.
Pakistan is one of the countries that have been ruled by their military for a long time.
That's a constant worry that the military, if it perceives disorder, could be tempted to intervene again. So, yeah, Serbia is an interesting case because their Prime Minister, Aleksandar Vučić, has been approaching what we see classified as spin dictatorship. So he has used some of the same techniques to control the media, using public advertising to buy loyalty, publicly attacking his critics. I believe he got reelected, but I haven't seen the results. If he does get reelected, then it seems likely to us that he will consolidate into something like a spin dictator in his next term.
In the few last minutes we have on the show, I want to return to Russia, a country that you have written about in the past as well. Have you been able to retain contacts with people in Russia? Can people who you trust still contact you without worrying about getting into trouble?
Well, I mean, this is very sad, but most of the people I know well are no longer in Russia. There's been a massive exodus some of the best people, I would say, in Russia, the people with consciences, the people who have in the past stood out against repressive government. So most of my friends are scattered in this diaspora that we now see in countries around Russia's borders, Georgia, Armenia, or further away in parts of Western Europe. So, of course, they can speak freely, but it's just everybody is trying to absorb the shock of how far backwards Russia has gone in the last month or so.
But Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Wednesday that the world is entering a historic stage in international relations, which opens an opportunity for Russia and China to lead a new world order. At the opening of a meeting with Wang Yi, China's foreign minister in Beijing, they said, we together with you and with our sympathizers will move toward a multipolar, just, democratic world order. They're calling this a democratic world order?
Yeah, well, they would like that, wouldn't they, to lead a new world order? Easier said than done. I don't see that alliance as really creating some kind of new model that other countries will want to follow. China is interesting in that it calls itself democratic. People's Democratic Republic of Korea, North Korea, also put democratic in its official name. But what they mean by democracy is certainly not liberal parliamentary democracy. It's more, as I understand it, this idea that the leader has some kind of mystical identification with the people, with the masses, which is never actually tested through elections and an honest system of representative government.
And we have to leave it there, unfortunately. Okay. We've run out of time. But my great thanks to Daniel Treisman, professor of political science at UCLA and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, co-author with Sergei Guraev, who is a professor of economics and director of graduate studies in economics at Sciences Po in Paris, of the book we've been discussing, Spin Dictators, The Changing Face of Tyranny in the 21st Century. It's from Princeton University Press. It's been a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. If you're just discovering this program and would like to hear more of our one-hour deep dive interviews, you can access our over 600 past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. Our podcast, which recently surpassed 1 million plays, is available on iTunes, Apple, and everywhere else you can get your podcasts. And if you'd like to write to me, my email address is leonardlopate@WBAI.org. Before I sign off today, I need to ask you to support WBAI to keep the show coming to you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. We are asking all of our listeners who have the means to do so to make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by calling 212-209-2950 or by going online to give to WBAI.org. That's given them the number 2, WBAI.org. Please do it right now. We need your help to keep bringing you this unique, in-depth content, information you usually don't get anywhere else. And as I mentioned earlier, anyone who makes a contribution of $50 or more in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large can receive a copy of the book we've been discussing, Spin Dictators, The Changing Face of Tyranny in the 21st Century, by Professor Daniel Treisman and Sergei Guraev. please call now. Make that contribution. 212-209-2950. Go online to give2wbai.org. You might also consider becoming a sustaining member, what we call a BAI buddy. And you can do that for $10 a month or more, and you will receive a WBAI tote bag as a thank you gift. But either way, I hope you'll call right now, because WBAI relies 100% on listener donations. We don't take ads or foundation grants or anything else. So one more time, please call to keep the only, this historic station, the only one on the New York radio dial that's 100% listener sponsored, alive and thriving with your tax deductible support. Call 212-209-2950 or go online to give2wbai.org. And we hope you can join us tomorrow, when my guest will be one of our favorite regulars, Bob Hennelly, with a discussion of the latest political developments in our area and the country as a whole. We'll see you then.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. The world still has time to avoid the most extreme dangers of climate change, but only if nations cut greenhouse gas pollution much faster than they are now, according to a landmark international climate science report. The report issued today is the latest by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a United Nations body that brings together the world's researchers to assess prevailing science on planetary warming. As a crucial near-term step, substantial reduction in the use of fossil fuels would need to happen, the report finds. And by 2050, low-carbon energy like solar and wind power will need to supply the majority of the world's energy. This latest report comes amidst a renewed push for oil and gas drilling as the war in Ukraine drives a spike in oil prices. Carbon emissions already roared back to their highest levels ever in 2021, rebounding after a decline during the pandemic. President Biden today joined a growing chorus of world leaders condemning Russia after horrifying scenes of mass graves and murdered civilians in Ukraine emerged over the weekend. Human Rights Watch said Sunday that it had documented a series of abuses allegedly committed by Russian forces in Ukraine, including rape and murder. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of genocide after his government reported a massacre in the town of Bucha, northwest of the capital Kyiv. President Biden called for a war crimes trial against Russian President Vladimir Putin and more sanctions against Russia. NATO Chief Jens Stoltenberg said the violence was horrific and absolutely unacceptable. And United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said an independent probe into the killings is essential. The Senate Judiciary Committee convened today to debate and vote on President Biden's nomination of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. It's the next step in Jackson's confirmation process as she seeks to make history as the first black woman to serve on the nation's highest court. The committee, composed of 11 Democrats and 11 Republicans, is expected to deadlock on Jackson's nomination, which would force an additional procedural vote to advance the nomination for consideration by the full Senate. Senate Democratic leaders are aiming to confirm Jackson before the upper chamber leaves Friday for a two-week recess. And while she can win approval with just Democratic support, the White House is hoping Jackson will be confirmed with bipartisan backing. Jackson will receive at least one GOP vote, as Senator Susan Collins of Maine announced last week she will support Jackson's nomination. And a first-of-its-kind examination of the coronavirus pandemic's impact on low-income communities shows that COVID-19 has been twice as deadly in poor counties as in wealthy ones. According to the study released today by the Poor People's Campaign, the 300 counties with the highest death rates have an average poverty rate of 45%. and household median incomes on average $23,000 lower than counties with lower rates of COVID. Reverend Dr. William Barber II, co-chair of the National Poor People's Campaign, says what the report reveals is a damning indictment of the U.S. government's pandemic response. Quote, "The neglect of poor and low-wealth people in this country during a pandemic is immoral, shocking, and unjust, especially in the light of the trillions of dollars that profit-driven entities received." Close quote. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 53 degrees, mostly cloudy.